Well, greetings once again to all of Turdville. It is Thursday, noon Eastern, which is our regular starting time slot for Access to Access. And this week we have a real treat. We're going to kind of go off the beaten path just a little bit, not just talk specifically about the metals and trading and stuff like that. Instead, we've got a guest that I'm really excited to bring back. It's Patrick Heller. Patrick is a, he runs one of, actually Michigan's largest rare coin and precious metals dealer. You can find him online at libertycoinservice.com. He's been writing about the precious metals for quite some time. He's one of the first guys I read was I was really starting to get interested in this stuff five, six, 7 years ago. And I actually got a chance to meet Pat face-to-face at Freedom Fest a couple years ago. You remember that, Patrick?
Yes, I do.
Always a fun party and interesting speakers out there. And so anyway, I thought, gosh, I know a lot of folks out there are not only investors in precious metal, but investors in numismatics and collectors. And I thought, boy, no greater expert that I know of than Patrick Heller. And so here he is. Patrick, thank you very much for spending some time with us here in Turdville.
This is going to be fun.
Like I said, in introducing you, you run this the largest precious metals and rare coin dealer in Michigan, but you're a renowned expert across the U.S. In numismatics and coin collecting. You've been doing it, I think, since you were a kid, right? Isn't it kind of like...
I became a collector in 1964, so I passed the half century mark.
Oh my gosh, how about that? And I'm sure you've got the gray hairs to prove it, right?
Yes, I do.
Something like that. And your business you founded more than 30 years ago, if what I'm reading is right. And you've been doing this for a while.
I became the second owner of the company in 1981. So yeah, I've been buying and selling rare coins and precious metals for over three decades.
Well, that's where we wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit. Like I said, I've already got a handful of questions in queue, folks dying to get your opinion on certain things. And I know that everybody listening has questions as well. But I just, you know, I want one thing I wanted to ask you about as we get started, because this is something that I think it's relevant to me, and I'm sure it's relevant to most everybody out there. A lot of us worry about precious metals confiscation. You know, there certainly is a precedent for that in the past. I'm not sure how it would work if it were to be tried again, because certainly people would know it was coming, unlike what happened in 1933. I just want to get your opinion about that. I know you sent me this morning a new column you've written about the idea of precious metals in an IRA, which I guess there's some a lot of people are doing that. A lot of companies are marketing that. But again, your IRAs are maybe something that might be subject to government nationalization at some point. You know, we worry about that too. And so I want to ask you about your thoughts on that. What do you think the likelihood is of that? And then one extra point to this, and I'll let you go and talk about this. I hear stories every once in a while about people getting into metals and buying pre-1933 coins, because they weren't confiscated last time, and paying extra premium and buying these really old coins for that reason. So as a dealer, I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as well. So anyway, that's a long question, my friend. I'm going to just sit back and let you answer it.
All right. I don't think there's much prospect for the U.S. government to try to get its hands on people's gold or silver, and there actually was something of an effort to call in silver in 1934 beyond what the government did with their mandatory fully compensated redemption program in 1933. The main reason I don't think it's going to happen is, the main reason is there isn't enough money in it for the U.S. government. A number of years ago, I did a calculation, and I estimated that if the government tried to do that again, about the most they could get is 80 million ounces of gold. And if you multiply that by the current price of gold, you're talking maybe $100 billion, which isn't going to do anything for the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's not much gold.
back in 1933, the gold that was turned in after the government increased the price to $35 an ounce, that was enough to cover 1.5 years government budget at the time. And there's just, you know, people, Americans couldn't buy gold for 40 years from 1933 to 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So they got out of the habit of thinking of owning some. And the percentage of the population that has been buying it since then, since it's been legal to own, is just a tiny fraction. So there's proportionately a lot less precious metals to get their hands on. And even silver, that's a smaller market than gold. So that's the main reason I don't think it's going to happen. The second reason I suspect that won't happen is that there is a much larger target that the U.S. government could go after, and that's private retirement account assets.
Yep.
One report I saw last week said the total is currently about $9 trillion. That's a lot more interesting to the U.S. government than going after maybe $100 billion worth, and that could make a difference in government finances. There have been proposals one way or another to try to get at some of those assets, starting early in President Clinton's term. One proposal that came out in 2008 would have encouraged people to turn in their assets after the markets crashed in the Great Recession, luring them by promising they could have their assets replaced with U.S. government debt at the old values of the assets before the market crashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's if we have another market crash in the next year or two, the government could bring that out again saying, well, we'd like to replace all these assets with treasury debt, and we'll do that before the values of your stocks and bonds and currencies collapsed. And in that instance, I think you'd have people rushing to turn in whatever assets they have in their retirement accounts in order to get government debt.
And that, I guess that kind of goes toward what you said about what you've been writing about the idea then of holding precious metal in your IRA. You got to be wary of potential IRA, not only voluntary, but maybe involuntarily being confiscated.
Yeah, there's just too much total assets in private retirement accounts, including precious metals, IRAs, for the governments to keep their hands off forever. You have, I believe it's 8 countries already, including Argentina, France, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, the Dominican Republic, Ireland, that have totally nationalized private retirement account assets, or partially so, just so far this century. So it's not a totally off-the-wall idea. And you even have well-respected people like Steve Forbes of Forbes magazine and commodity guru Jim Rogers both have said they anticipate the government is not going to keep their hands off for too many more years.
Right, right. Well, and I would imagine that if looking at it that way, the second part of that question about owning or paying up in premium for kind of antique coins, you know, pre-1933 coins, in your mind, probably not necessary. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what do you think? I mean, is that?
Yeah, I don't think it's worth doing if your objective in doing so is thinking that these are something that would be exempt from a potential call-in of gold in the future. Most of the pre-1933 gold coins were not exempt in the 1933 call-in. There was an exemption for coins of special collector value, but very few United States gold coins or world gold coins at the time had a special collector value. The ones that are being marketed by coin dealers today, almost all, were not exempt back in 1933.
Well, then there you go. I'd say that's a rather important distinction as well, wouldn't you? Something
yes.
To know. Well, all right. Well, I tell you what, with that, I've got so many questions piled up from listeners and from subscribers that I think I probably better just dive right in. So as we change gears, I'll just go straight to the first question I have. This was from, call this person Tasha, who wants to know your opinion on what is the safest gold coin in terms of what is the gold coin that is least likely to be counterfeited? I mean, there's a lot of concern out there about, you know, like kilo bars that have been salted with tungsten, things like that. So have you ever seen a counterfeit gold coin, or, and what is your opinion on what is the least likely to be counterfeited gold coin?
I have seen a number of counterfeit coins over the years, although as a percentage, it's very small. Mm-hmm. The coins that have collector value above precious metal value are at greater risk of being counterfeited than those that just trade for precious metal value.
Oh, okay, that's good to know.
When you sell one for precious metal value, the way to make a profit on it is to try to pass it off when it's made out of some other material that costs less than gold. Gold is very dense, so you can't really make a counterfeit that would be passable unless you made it out of a more valuable metal, or you made it out of tungsten that has a specific gravity almost identical to gold. But the cost of working with tungsten is so high that about the cheapest way to make a counterfeit gold coin that would pass, or gold bar, is to make it out of gold. However, you do have, there's been some bars that were drilled on the edge and had tungsten plugs put in the drilled out area, and then you put a little gold cap on that plug and smooth the edge and the weight comes out right. I've seen that happen on a couple of South African gold Krugerrands. And you also have some where you just have a large mass of tungsten and it's almost like a gold foil over the edge.
Right.
To get the weight and the dimensions right. Most of the counterfeits that you'll see of bullion items, they don't try to do a very good job of making passable ones. The few that I've seen in our store normally weigh just over half of what the real thing would weigh.
Oops.
And when somebody like a coin dealer that handles them all day long holds it in their hand, and it's happened to me, I don't even have to look at it. I say, it's fake.
Yeah.
It just jumps right out at you because the weight's wrong.
Yeah. I would imagine, though, you have other safeguards in place in your own business. If it's marginal, you think, might be. What do you do as a business owner to protect against that?
If you have any doubts, you can weigh it. And manufacturers are real precise on the weights of the coins. If you can also, and some coin dealers, and mine happens to be one, we have an X-ray spectrometer which will analyze the first, the infinitesimal part of the exterior of the coins.
Mm-hmm.
For what is it made out of. It doesn't go all the way through the coin, so it's not a perfect thing. And you look for the quality of production. When you see a counterfeit United States gold coin that's about the right diameter and weight, invariably it just doesn't look right.
Yeah.
Compared to what they normally do. The quality of production is getting better over the years, so just because something looks right isn't a for sure safe feature anymore. The same thing is there are grading services that encapsulate coins, and some of the counterfeiters will even make counterfeit holders to make it look like they have been sent to the grading services. At the end of last year, Congress passed and President Obama signed a bill that expanded the Hobby Protection Act so that anybody that counterfeits a coin, not only the manufacturers are liable, but anybody who tries to pass it is themselves liable for trying to pass counterfeit coins. And if you make a counterfeit grading holder, or you make like a counterfeit of a privately manufactured bar, the owners of the grading services or that make the real bars can sue for trademark infringement. So you can get prosecuted by the government and by the companies whose product you imitated.
Okay. And just to kind of close this one out, I mean, at that coin, individual coin level, the ASC or the Maple, I mean, this isn't something you see a lot of, though, right? I mean, this is just something maybe you've seen only very occasionally.
I'm unfortunately seeing more of it as time goes on. The eBay internet auctions had a category to sell reproductions. When you look at the pictures for the lot, you'd see them properly marked as saying copy or replica. But when you get the actual product, that distinguishing mark wasn't on the pieces you received. And there have been some people who have gone all over the state of Michigan where I am trying to sell these products. They buy them for a small fraction of the price of the supposed silver value or gold value. I've seen some gold bars or so-called gold bars and some silver bars that were counterfeited. And some dealers just were too casual and got taken on those. Fortunately, my companies had almost no trouble with that.
Great example of working with experienced, reputable, wise dealers such as yourself. No question about it. The next question comes from someone named Duple. Gotta love these internet names, don't you? Here's something I know nothing about, so hopefully this makes sense to you. Duple collects brilliant, uncirculated piece dollars, and he wants to know your thoughts on the differences between PCGS grading and NGC grading.
Okay. There is an average perception that the professional coin grading service, which is PCGS, may be a little stricter than the Numismatic Guarantee Corporation, which is NGC. Okay. They're the two most widely traded and are popular grading services. But that doesn't tell you about any specific coin, and it also doesn't tell you about over time. Even though the grading services theoretically are standardizing the grading, dealers that look at a lot of coins generally agree that the standards get a little tighter or a little looser over time. So you still have to look at the coin saying, this coin in this grading service is as nice or not as nice as supposedly an equal coin by another grading service. And it's even if you say on average PCGS is perceived as being slightly stricter, that doesn't tell you that if it's a PCGS coin, it's automatically going to be nicer than NGC.
Okay.
You still have to look at the coins.
Fair enough. All right. Here's one from Heath. This is kind of a, I think, a good specific coin question. So let me ask you about his specific coin, then I'll have a follow-up question for you. Heath owns, he sent me a picture, a 1776 William Moulton, New Hampshire Colonial Copper coin. And he got that from somebody. I think he inherited it or something. He wants to know, is that something that is valuable? And I think the follow-up question is, there's probably all kinds of people listening to us that don't collect coins or anything, but, you know, they got one from their grandfather that they've been keeping in their desk drawer or something like that. And they've always wondered if, you know, what the value is. I mean, is it possible, the follow-up question, I guess, is to email you, you know, a picture of what they have just to get a rough idea of you know, if it's the value, that type of thing, or how does that work? So anyway, the specific one about this Moulton Colonial Copper coin and then other stuff.
Okay. If it is a genuine piece, This is an issue from New Hampshire during the Revolutionary War. It has some value. I see that one sold in auction 3 years ago for $172,000.
I'd say that has some value.
However, you can also go into souvenir shops along the East Coast in the original 13 colonies and buy souvenir sets that includes replicas of this kind of item.
Mm-hmm.
There are references that show what is the proper weight of genuine items, and normally coin dealers have that information available in their stores in the reference catalogs they have, or you can find this information online, like what is the weight of a genuine molten issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the accurate weight, it's not real.
Right.
It's probably one of those picked up in a souvenir store. That is something that my company helps customers with all the time. And unfortunately, we've never had somebody walk in with something that might be a $50,000 or $100,000 more item if it was genuine, and we've never had it turn out to be genuine.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
The weight is the first thing that'll give it off. The next is you look at the method of manufacture, and the replicas do not have the quality of manufacture that the real pieces would.
So really the best thing they can do, they may maybe email you a picture and say, well, what is this? Is this something we should look deeper at? And if you say, yeah, then you really got a coin dealer such as yourself really has to look at it and inspect it and do a number of things to it to determine whether or not it's authentic.
If necessary, most of these pieces, it's about 5 seconds and we can say, no, this isn't the real thing.
Got it. Got it. All right. Next one comes from Robert. And again, here's one. I don't know what the heck Robert's talking about, but you probably do. Robert wants to thank you first for all your service to the coin community over the years and wants to know, what is your opinion as to the sentencing of Bernard von Nothaus in federal court after such a long delay?
I think the judge was trying to find some pretext to take it pretty light on Mr. von Nothaus, and the in-house sentence for, I think it was 6 months or 3 months or something, is about as light as he could do. He also took over 3 years to render the sentence. There is still the issue to be settled of which assets the government's going to confiscate and which are not. It looks like the judge is going to say the pieces that were fabricated that on which he was convicted for counterfeiting are not going to be returned to the owners. But for instance, there were a lot of ounces of silver and silver bar form waiting to be manufactured. And some of it was not titled in the company that made the Liberty Silver pieces, and that part is or probably will be returned to the owners.
Ooh, okay.
In the circumstances, I think the judge was as sympathetic to what Bernard von Nothaus did. There wasn't any evidence in the trial that anybody had really lost money being so-called taken in by these counterfeits. And I'm sure that was something that taken into account by the judge.
Okay. All right. Next one comes from Dennis. Dennis says he has some certified Silver Eagles and certified Morgan Silver Dollars. He's wondering your opinion as to whether he should hold on to those or sell them to buy other silver coins and bars that are not certified.
It depends on the grading service. There are a number of grading services created to make people think they were a respected, easily tradable coin, but it's really just a marketing tool. Those coins don't have any advantage being in a plastic holder because when they're traded, the dealers will look at the coins and ignore the holder. In general, if somebody says, what I have may not be the optimum thing to have, so I'm thinking about getting rid of it to get something else it might be better to do, and I'm not aggressive at recommending that people do that. When you do such a trade, you probably would get out of it merchandise that would be worth at most 85 to 90% of what you just gave up. So even if it outperforms what you traded out, you have to overcome that just to break even with what you already started with.
Yeah.
There are some circumstances where something may not suit a collection, or if you're improving the quality, then it's worth trading in a piece to trade up. But the answer to the question, there's no flat answer to the question, except there's a lot of circumstances where even if somebody could have something different that's better, that I think it's worth doing a trade.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a good segue into the next question I have. This one comes from Gaz. He must have numismatics and just regular bullion, because his question is, and it's specific to silver, is he wants to know, is the premium for numismatics justified at the point of liquidation? And is there a ratio you can point to for one who has had to accumulate over time? Like 1 ounce of numismatic for every 10 to 20 ounces of just straight up maples or bullion bars? Do you ever think of it that way?
Actually, I do. And the answer is different for every single person.
Sure.
When you're, I consider just owning outright precious metals, whether it's in bar or coin form, to be a conservative approach, because there's less concerns about counterfeiting or grading, and you have a closer buy-sell spread on the wholesale market.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have rare coins, it is possible that you will have greater appreciation over time, but along with that, you also have a greater risk of a loss. So if somebody's not comfortable being risky, sticking to precious metals makes the most sense. And for some that says, you know, I'm young or I have adequate wealth and I can handle more risk and I understand the downside possibilities, they could go more in that direction. Obviously, there's a lot of collectors that don't purchase any precious metals. And actually, I didn't buy precious metals to start with. I became a collector in 64, and I bought my first gold and silver to be gold and silver in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
So people can change over time.
Yeah.
But the answer depends on everybody's circumstances. And also with collector coins, you're looking at a longer time frame for a payoff than generally with precious metals.
And the risk that you mentioned, is that like a counterfeit risk? Is it a risk of the premium kind of collapsing in a declining price? Or could you define that a little more, Pat?
You have the risk that you may overpay when you purchase it.
Okay.
And all beginning collectors just about have the experience of buying something and they later realize that I shouldn't have bought that or I overpaid for that.
Sure.
Which is, it was nice when I started collecting where you collect coins out of change, the downside was minimized as you learn how to grade and stuff like that. Or you simply conceptually bought the items that were not going to increase in value. If you get into the right markets and you make sure you get good value, that's you'll be ahead of the game over those who don't do their homework. The guy that founded Liberty Coin Service in the 1970s, when he was buying collections, would ask people when they were selling, if they'd made a profit or a loss, and sort of what their experience of being a collector was. What he found out is that of people who would buy rare coins and became a collector and stuck with it at least 5 years, that over 90% of them made money when they sold. But people who said, I hear rare coins is a good investment, I don't really want to pay any attention to it, but I want to own some, that when those people went to sell, over 90% of them lost money.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me, again, the value of a experienced and reputable dealer, again, such as yourself, is pretty important in guiding you through that process, if that is something you want to do.
Definitely can help.
Well, you're being very generous with your time, and I very much appreciate it. I've got one more question in queue, and so I want to ask you that one, and if anybody else wants to add one, again, you've got the dialogue box right here on your GoToWebinar control panel. Feel free to add one if you'd like. But the last one that I have, at least pending, comes from Ed. And Ed has a question about junk silver. You know, you see the, you can buy bags of it online from some of the online bullion dealers. Do you have any, I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, but he wants to know if you know where it all comes from. You mentioned kind of picking through coins back in your youth, you know, pulling out ones that were more valuable than others. But where does all the current junk silver come from? Is there like a giant warehouse somewhere where all the PM sellers draw it from? And frankly, how much of it is still out there that's not in, you know, already in private hands?
We don't have statistics available on how much of what the U.S. Mint struck over the years was melted down, such as in the 1979-1980 bullion boom. Large amounts were melted down, but when the United States government has been making silver coins that traded on the basis of silver content for 70 years, there's a tremendous amount of it. I've had the opportunity to actually visit the vaults of some wholesalers in the country, and one of them that I visited had over $1 million face value of 90% silver coin, what most people call junk silver, just sitting in their vault.
That's a lot.
I mean, yeah, $1 million face value?
Yeah, that's a lot of junk.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So there are large quantities of it around compared to what I would personally think, or most people would think of as being a large quantity. If you have somebody that wants to put out an order for $1 billion worth, and there are such orders that do appear on the market, they don't deal with companies like me when they talk that.
Sure.
But that could be a situation where the supply would be difficult to find.
And you see that occasionally reflected. Some of the online dealers, you know, the premiums shoot up and then they come back down and that kind of stuff. I would imagine that's somewhat of a reflection of how much is readily available. But like you said, hard to know how much exactly is out there. Well, I said that, and I've got a couple of quick ones that have come in while we've been talking. This is a specific coin question from Bim Jeem. Sounds like somebody maybe had a little Jim Beam in their life. Wants to know about the possible collectability of he's got some wheat pennies issued in the 1920s from the Philly Mint, no S's or D's, very much heavily circulated, he says. Is that something, though, that is a collectible?
It has a little bit of collectible value. Most of those in our store, we buy at 3 cents each and sell them for in bulk for 10 cents each on up. There's a lot of labor in handling them. And unfortunately, that's not something that gets paid to the customer. If you are able to get them at face value, it'd be fine to hold on to them. But I don't think it's something to think of in terms of investing in that if you have to go out and buy them from a coin dealer or another collector.
Yeah, and you're paying a premium probably and that kind of thing too.
Yes.
And I've got a Isaiah wants to know kind of a general question about owning and trading rare coins. they're kind of done. It's almost done on an individual basis, is it not? I mean, you've got some as a collector and you decide, hey, this has probably gone up in value, and you find out what the value is, and then you take it to a dealer, probably as an intermediary, and sell it. Is that pretty much how that works?
That is a way to do that. Some people try to deal collector to collector, and you can try doing that, say, online through eBay or other companies. There's no perfect venue to manage that. If someone has specifically really valuable coins, it could be that putting them in an auction will expose the coin to buyers that across the country or maybe even around the world that want to buy that at the maximum price. So there's no one-size-fits-all answer to that. It just depends on the kind of item someone has.
Yeah, I would imagine. And the last question I have is a follow-up. I mean, if you remember Dennis's question earlier about certified Eagles and certified Morgan silver dollars, and exchanging those into non-certified bullion. And this might be so specific that maybe I'll just have him suggest he gives you a call at your company. But he has what he says that an 1892 Carson City Morgan dollar graded extra fine. And I guess that's just a good example of a collectible numismatic coin, and whether that's something that I guess his question is whether the premium on something of that is high enough that it's appropriate to switch into just straight bullion or not.
That is one worth considering.
Okay.
It's worth several hundred dollars. There have been some research books, one or two that came out in the last decade about Carson City Mint coinage. And when you have research books like that come out, you find a spurt in the collecting of that area.
Sure.
So that has happened with Carson City coinage and run some prices up. I don't know that coin in particular in that grade, but it's not that hard for me to trace its performance and price over the years. And there are some that if it's gone up 10 times in price in the last 10 years, that is probably one well worth considering selling versus one that might only have gone up 10% in the last 10 years.
Got it. Okay. There you go. Well, that makes sense. Well, I tell you what, Patrick, I want to thank you. I mean, you've just been, this is live, just exactly what I thought it would be. I mean, a tremendous educational experience. But however, before we wrap up, we have this kind of tradition in these webinars of what we call the final four, which is just kind of four quick, kind of fun questions that you can usually answer in a sentence or even just a couple of words. So if you're ready, since we've cleared out the queue, I think I'll hit you with the final four.
All right, I'm ready.
We've talked about you being in Michigan. I think you're outside of Lansing or in Lansing, isn't that right?
In Lansing.
Okay, home of the Spartans, right?
Yes.
How cold is it there right now?
It's cold enough that the schools were canceled today.
Okay.
Right now it's minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh my God. Oh, jeez. All right. Well, that counts as being cold. And that's not even the wind chill, right?
That's not including the wind chill.
Oh, good heavens. Okay. Now, question number two. You live in the home of Sparty, but I read in your bio that you're actually graduated from the University of Michigan. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
I was a fan of Michigan State first, but I asked a counselor at high school what would be a good college to go to, and they said Michigan, so I said okay.
Fair enough. Well, what do you think of Jim Harbaugh?
I loved him as a football player at Michigan. I have high hopes for what he'll do.
Fair enough. Yeah, I would think he's going to make it bring them back. Yes. All right. Also, in your bio, I read you are an avid traveler. You've been to all 50 states and you've been to 29 countries. Is that still a number 29 or have you increased that?
Well, right now it is. Next week it'll be 30. I'm going to go to the Bahamas for a short vacation and get out of the cold.
Well, that seems logical. I guess my question then is, Of all the places you've been, I mean, obviously there's a place you haven't been. Where would you most like to go that you haven't been? Not counting the Bahamas.
I keep a list of that. Australia, New Zealand is one on the list. Ireland is one. Iceland is one. East Africa, like Kenya and Tanzania, is another. And actually the Bahamas makes my top five list.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And lastly, this has kind of become a standard Final Four question over the last few months. You and I are having lunch there in Lansing today, let's say. And at the end of our lunch, I pull out an envelope with about 1,200 Federal Reserve notes in it. And you have the option to take that $1,200 and go buy yourself 1 ounce of gold or about 70 ounces of silver. Which would you purchase today?
I'd buy the silver.
And why?
Not even close.
Okay. And why is that? Just that's a fault.
It's not scientific, but I anticipate that the long-term gold-silver ratio will be somewhere in the 35 to 40 range.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's up at the more than 70, that tilts it in favor of acquiring silver.
Certainly makes sense to me. I think a lot of people look at it the same way. Well, I'll tell you what, my friend, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today. Again, your wisdom and experience in this area is just invaluable. I know that everybody listening is probably thinking about numismatics all the way down, you know, like I said, to just maybe a coin that they got from their grandmother 30 years ago. If someone wanted to get in touch with you or find out more about Liberty Coin Service, what do they do, Patrick?
Well, I can go online to check out our website, libertycoinservice.com. I also write for various online numismatic places. You can check numismaster.com or numismaticnews.net. Those are both sponsored by Krause Publications. I've had some articles on coinweek.com. I wrote in the past for coinupdate.com. And a lot of what I have written has been picked up elsewhere.
Yes, it has. And do you have an 800 number that people can call to?
Sure. It's 800-933-4720.
And just say, hey, I'd like to talk to Patrick, please.
Not next week, though.
Not next week, because you're going to be thawing out. All right, fair enough. Hey, Patrick, again, thank you. And again, for all that you do and all of your service to the community at large. But it's just great to have you as an expert in this field. And we really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you, sir.
And hopefully we'll do it again sometime soon.
All right.
All right, my friend. Have a great rest of your day.